Welcome to the third episode of Culture Wars, Spheres of Influence in International Relations. On this show, we talk about how a country's cultural activities, through sports, entertainment, and other avenues, are used to spread cultural influence across borders that ultimately affect the power balance between countries and international relations. I am Jordan Garcia.
And I'm Zoya Nawaz, and we're hosting this podcast sponsored by the Keck Center for International and Strategic Studies at Claremont McKenna College.
Today's episode will focus on how South Korea has used soft power to rise on the world stage. Our discussion today will be about Hallyu, otherwise known as the Korean Wave, with the exportation of Korean popular culture abroad.
We will focus on Korean popular music and how it has become a worldwide phenomenon, in addition to Korean dramas and films gaining increased international popularity. These mediums of cultural influence have boosted South Korea's soft power beyond its small territorial boundaries into the rest of the world through entertainment.
Our guest for today is Crystal Anderson, an accomplished expert on South Korean media studies, popular culture, and pop music, otherwise known as K-pop. Dr. Anderson has published several articles on Afro-Asian cultural studies and K-pop, while also managing several digital humanities projects for the genre, including KPK, K-pop Collective, and K-pop Culture. Her book, So and So, African American Music and K-pop, details the influence of African American music styles on K-pop.
She's currently an assistant director and a professor at George Mason University. We're so happy to have her here to talk to us about Korean spheres of influence through K-pop. Welcome, Dr. Anderson.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Dr. Anderson, before we dive straight into K-pop, why don't we first introduce what this concept of Hallyu or the Korean Wave is? Like, what does it refer to? When did it start?
Sure. So, Hallyu or the Korean Wave is a cultural movement of global facing Korean popular culture. Depending on which genre you're looking at, most people attach the global spread to K-drama in East Asia, so China and Japan. And then in later waves, you get the spread of other Korean cultural products like K-pop and Korean movies.
Yeah, so the K-pop industry is also quite different than other music genres in the way that it grooms and stylizes its artist from the initial audition to training years and to the idol debut. So can you talk more and give a brief overview of how like this industry functions with crafting the idol and such, and how has the setup of K-pop industry allowed for it to expand as much as it has?
Sure. So when we're talking about the creation of idols, they are part of a larger K-pop landscape because you have other genres like K-hip-hop, you have K-R&B. And so those people are developed differently, but they're also linked to the idols themselves. Idols are the most visible. When people think about K-pop, they think about boy and girl groups that sing and dance, and then they also do extra musical activities like hosting or being in K-dramas, starring in movies, doing photo shoots, doing endorsements. And so that's what I'm going to talk about because that's the industry that people think about the most. And it's probably the most visible element of the Korean music industry. So with K-pop idols, they are part of a casting and training system. There are auditions that used to happen solely or largely in South Korea, but now have expanded to other countries to allow other members from other countries to be in K-pop groups. They tend to start young, which has caused a little bit of controversy because they also used to have them sign extremely long contracts, and that has been amended in the last few years. The thing that has not changed, though, is the kind of casting and training system. So some people are casted off the street. Some people are casted through auditions. Some people know somebody in the industry already. But they all have some kind of talent that the company can build on, whether that's vocals, whether that's choreography, whether that's a combination of the two, whether that's good looks. There is something that the company feels like it can build on. So they take individuals in and then they train them. So this is the other half of the casting and training system. So at any given time, you have a plethora of trainees, and trainees will go from one company to another company. Some they used to do trainee swaps back in the day. So they are trained not only in vocals and choreography, but they're also trained in something we would call maybe etiquette. In the Motown record company, they used to call it artist development. So it's all these other things, how to talk to people, how to carry yourself, how to answer questions, how to interact with other people, how to interact with fans. And often includes other things like learning a new language. Some people are interested in choreography. Some people are interested in songwriting. Some people are interested in composing and arranging. And that training process continues. So for instance, in SM Entertainment, people continue to train. So they come to the company known for one thing and then they develop into something else. So for example, Kai in EXO was known as one of the primary dancers of EXO, and then he drops an album. What year are we in? Because now I don't even remember. I think it was either this year or last year, he drops an album. So during that whole time, he's continued to train, not just develop his vocals, but to also hone his dancing skills. So the casting and training system is something that's ongoing for rookies, for trainees, for people who are already established. They'll put you in a group, and there's been some controversy about how quote unquote real the groups are. But I think that now that we're into more than 20 some years of K-pop, we have groups that are very long lived and they stay together for various reasons. And so whereas they may put you in a group with someone you may not know, but then again, you do know them because you're all trainees. You begin to develop those kinds of relationships with the people who are in the group with you, and then you debut. But once again, the training system isn't over, so you continue to train and you continue to get better. And depending what company you're in, you may also be able to either develop in other kinds of ways. So in terms of songwriting or choreography, or some people have completely largely left K-pop to go into things like acting. And so the casting and training system really encompasses all of those things. And that they continue, the idols continue to develop the longer they're in that kind of system.
Thank you for that great answer. We can tell that like K-pop is just such a really big industry that we just can't possibly cover in one episode. But you briefly touched on the fact that idols have foreign language lessons, foreign auditions outside of Korea. And this contributes to the globalized factor of K-pop and how, you know, they work really hard to like reach into like other markets outside of East Asia and South Korea. Can you talk about how the globalization, like the internet, really did propel like K-pop abroad? I think back in the early 2000s, if you were a Western fan, it was probably really hard for you to get into K-pop because it wasn't as widespread before. There was not a lot of Korean content on YouTube, but now every K-pop group has their own page and there's like the comeback shows and everything. So can you just talk about like the globalization factor?
Sure. So the thing that distinguishes K-pop from Korean popular music in general, let's understand that Korean popular music existed long before K-pop came along. It's a particular kind of Korean popular music. And one of the things that makes it unique is the fact that it was designed to be global. And when the first groups were put together, that global meant East Asia, China, and Japan. But as things developed, that globalization went beyond East Asia. It's interesting because there's Korean popular music that's popular in Korea, less popular outside of Korea. And then you have K-pop, which is popular in Korea and also popular globally. So one of the great things and one of the interesting things to me that K-pop has done is that it has combined elements of other music traditions with Korean promotion and production strategies to produce something that's very different. K-pop sounds very different than the pop music that you find in other countries. At the same time, K-pop is really geared towards globalization, geared towards a global audience and simultaneously a domestic audience. Because as some scholars have posited, there are also aesthetic elements in K-pop that appeal to Koreans and they listen for that. That's at least what some scholars suggest. The other interesting thing about K-pop is that it appeals to a wide variety of people. When it's when K-pop says is global, it really is global. There's K-pop in Russia, there are K-pop fans in Saudi Arabia, there are K-pop fans in Latin America. And that's not something that other types of music have been able to accomplish at the level that K-pop has been able to accomplish it. So what is it about K-pop, which is very, you know, it's kind of got that, you know, gooey Korean center to it that makes it appealing to global audiences. I think that it's a music production and promotion, the way that they blend musical traditions, the way that they structure the music and the songs is very different and very identifiable. And something that, at least until this point, Korea has been unique in being able to do.
Yeah, so like when we're talking about all of this, do you think K-pop has gone mainstream now with BTS being nominated at Grammys and groups charting on the Billboard music charts at number one and appearing on American talk shows like Ellen's Show and Good Morning America? Is there a backlash from American and Western non-K-pop fans who fear this immersion of Korean culture in the West?
That's a really interesting question. So we can certainly say that BTS has had the most penetration into the American mainstream consciousness. And that was paved by several other idol artists in the United States, even though they're often characterized as not having the same kind of impact as BTS. And so you're talking about people like Wonder Girls and Rain and BoA, who all kind of made inroads. But it's also interesting and important to note that there is a vibrant set of subcultures in the United States as there are in other countries. And so other types of foreign popular culture have enjoyed incredible success being outside of the mainstream of the United States. So think about things like anime, think about things like foreign films from various countries. And I'm thinking about Hong Kong film in particular, enjoy very vibrant subcultures. We're going back to the original question about BTS being in the mainstream of American culture. They certainly have had the most visibility and the most penetration. The question, though, is how long is that going to be able to be sustained? And at this point, we don't know because we're still in the middle of it. We do know that the United States does not have a great history when it comes to mainstream acceptance of foreign language popular culture. So we've seen various Spanish-speaking artists, you know, appear in the mainstream, but not really continue to have that kind of input. So we will have to see. There are people who argue that we know that K-pop groups are different. So is, you know, one of the questions that comes up is BTS's entrance into the American mainstream opening the way for other K-pop groups? And to a certain extent, you can say yes, because you have had on American mainstream popular media the appearances of other K-pop groups like Seventeen and TXT and GOT7. So in that way, you are getting you're raising the visibility of K-pop, but the question now is how long will this last? American popular mainstream audiences, like they are in a lot of countries, are notoriously fickle when it comes to popular culture. And so we will have to see how much of an impact this has long-term, but definitely they have had the most visibility to date.
Yeah, and like you just mentioned, the acceptance of popular culture in the West. If you could briefly talk about Korean dramas, when you mentioned Hallyu, that it was before the growth of K-pop, but I always thought of that the growth of K-pop opened the world's eyes to pay attention to South Korea, which included other aspects of Korean culture, which is Korean film and TV, especially now that Netflix has signed contracts to buy Korean shows and films to display on the platform. Is it that Korean dramas were before K-pop globalized, or that K-pop led to the growth of other aspects of Korean culture to be paid attention to worldwide?
So it's the former. So in the first wave, because we're in, you know, depending on who you talk to, the third wave or the fourth wave of the Korean wave. And the first wave of the Korean wave was driven by K-drama, and that was in East Asia. So you had the phenomenal success of Winter Sonata in China, you had the in Japan, you had the popularity of Jewel in the Palace in China. And so that was the first wave that was largely contained in East Asia. The second wave was the wave that was driven by K-pop. And that's when you get Korean popular culture going beyond East Asia. And so that's what we're seeing the ramifications of today. But K-dramas are still incredibly popular. And yes, you're right. We're living in a golden age of access to Korean dramas, or access to certain Korean dramas, because I've been looking for some Korean dramas and I can't find them. And interestingly enough, they were a little bit more available when we had more outlets. And oddly enough, we did have more outlets for K-drama than we do now. But having K-drama on Netflix, having Netflix partner in terms of distribution with Korean broadcast systems to get access to those K-dramas by a larger audience is definitely something that we're seeing today, as we're also seeing the continued popularity of K-pop.
Yeah, because before K-pop, or I guess, like you just talked about, like the Hallyu wave, I don't think South Korea is probably as popular as it is today, that I think so many people want to learn the Korean language, or they want to study abroad in Korea, or they want to visit there. It's just really brought a lot more eyes to the relatively small country that it is.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, I was definitely going to say the same thing as Jorlyn did. So moving on, the South Korean government is heavily involved with the production of K-pop. Like, their Ministry of Culture subsidizes and provides tax incentives for companies to facilitate the spread of K-pop and Korean culture abroad. So why do they do this? And also, how is the system different from how Western governments are involved with their music industries?
That's a good question. I would say that we know that the South Korean government does provide subsidies for cultural products in South Korea, but we also have to recognize that the Korean agencies themselves are businesses, and they don't always have the same interests as the government. So when they can come together to spread K-pop, that's a really great thing, but sometimes they clash. And so it's difficult to say whether it's difficult to say whether the Korean government says, hey, take this money and we're going to pay for the spread of K-pop around the world, without considering the huge thing that stands in the middle of that transaction, which are the Korean agencies. But that being said, a few years ago, I got a K-drama calendar from the Korean embassy, and I'm like, oh, this is great. And so there is interaction, there is interplay between those, or among those things. I think that the Korean government is certainly invested in a very intentional kind of way for the spread of Korean culture. But this is not the first time that we've seen governments involved in the spread of their culture through things like music or arts. So for instance, the United States would send jazz musicians through Europe after World War II. And that was not just, you know, for fun. They had a mission, because they wanted them to spread American values in the wake of that huge global conflict. So I think what we're seeing now is a really contemporary example of what a lot of people call soft power. Is a very obvious, invisible example, because South Korea is like, here, take our stuff, please, take our stuff. In some ways, where we might see other countries do it in a more subtle kind of way. Also, remember, South Korea is a tiny country. And so they are really invested in the spread of their culture in a way that, for instance, the United States is invested in the spread of its culture, but it's bigger and it has a different kind of position on the world stage. And so they don't have to work at it in the same kind of way that South Korea does.
I'm so glad you touched on the topic of soft power, because that's exactly what this episode is about. On the same theme of K-pop politics, should the US government have something to fear about being the unrivaled music industry that it is in the West? How is Korea propelling their soft power through entertainment to the West? Like, China has even banned Korean dramas and music because of political disputes between South Korea and China. And there might even be some element that China might be perceiving the influx of Korean culture as a threat. So how does this compare, like, the U.S. perception of the influx of Korean culture?
You know, the American cultural perception is, it's not really threatened by a whole lot. So they, a lot of people in the mainstream, they think that K-pop is a fad, it's trendy, and like all trends, it'll come and it'll go. And we've, you know, previously talked about how, you know, subcultures actually are the staying power, I think, and the more important location to look at in terms of influence. But remember, even though K-pop is global, and even though the United States is the behemoth in terms of its politics and, you know, its place in the world, the second largest music industry is Japan, and it's literally down the street from Korea. So Korea has Japan on one hand, on one side. On the other side, as you pointed out, up until recently, it had access to China, which has a burgeoning economic class of people who would spend their disposable income on things like entertainment and Korean pop. But let's not think that there aren't other ways that K-pop is making its way over to China, even though officially there's a ban. So that's the interesting thing about the internet and how incredibly crucial the internet is to the global spread of K-pop. I think in the United States, we are not used to the United States not being the target. K-pop could literally never leave East Asia, and everybody would still be making a nice little chunk of change in terms of the agencies and profit. The spread of K-pop throughout the world helps to validate and spread Korean culture throughout the world. And they are playing the long game. And so, you know, every K-pop group that makes it on American television, that's just, you know, one further benefit. But economically speaking, they do not need the United States. And so the United States, however, and artists and producers in the United States have made this comment that one of the reasons why they work outside of the United States, one of the reasons why you see a lot of collaborations between American producers and Korean music agencies is that they feel like they get to be a little bit more creative over in Korea because of the state of popular music in the United States. You know, some people say that it's just kind of uninteresting and that they find music from other places much more interesting. And so the American music industry, not only is it big, it is also transnational and multinational. So it's a very complex and interesting question. But no, I don't think anybody's thinking K-pop is going to take over the American music industry, at least not at this point.
Yeah, so South Korea's largest export, even if it's not like a traditional product like technology that is exported, the music and the K-pop groups, the people are themselves the actual product. And I know like you briefly touched upon the notion of economics, but how do you think has the export of K-pop and the Korean popular culture propelled the Korean economy specifically, and then Korea's soft power on the world stage? Because Korea is relatively a small country and it has been able to gain a lot more power than its traditional workforce would, you know, allow it. So how has like the cultural influence right now, how has it like propelled the Korean economy a little more?
So we know that the Korean economy has, you know, like, as you said, products that it does rely on. But remember, Hallyu is about culture. It is not just about the profit that comes from culture. It's about the cultural impact. And so whereas there are other industries that may see a more direct economic impact in terms of how many cars or cell phones or, you know, things that are sold, I think K-pop being a culture industry reaps a different kind of profit. And you've already mentioned it. You have people who are learning the Korean language. And that's super huge. I remember somebody telling me that they were talking to someone in Korea and they said, why would anybody want to learn Korean? Only people in Korea speak Korean, but Korean is one of the fastest growing languages that people are taking up and learning in college. You have people who are interested in Korea and so they go. So that helps tourism. You have people who want to go and work in Korea. And so that's the culture profit benefit, I think, of K-pop, because it means raising Korea's standing or perception or characterization in the world.
That sounds like a great note to end on, Korea's standing on the world stage because of K-pop and just Korean popular culture now booming because of K-dramas and K-pop and everything. So just thank you, Dr. Anderson, for offering your insight into everything we've talked about today. There's just so much to learn. Again, we can't possibly cover it on one episode, but just thank you for coming on again.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think it will be very interesting to see how Korean culture continues to grow in the next couple of years in its nonstop worldwide appeal. And thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed being here.
Culture Wars podcast is sponsored by the Keck Center for International and Strategic Studies, and the music is brought to you by Kevin McLeod at The Incompetent Tech with the song titled Industrious Ferret. I'm Zoya Navaz.
And I am Jorlin Garcia. We hope you enjoyed today's episode and continue listening next time. Thank you.